Scaffold is supported by the Architecture Foundation, bringing new voices to the conversation about architecture in London and around the world. For more information and upcoming events, visit architecturefoundation.org.uk. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold. In this episode, I speak with the journalist and author Fernanda Eberstadt, whose new book, Bite Your Friends, Stories of the Body Militant, has just been published by Europa Editions. The book is organized around a collection of heroes or muses, including the ancient Greek cynic philosopher Diogenes, the early Christian martyr Perpetua, and such 20th century prophets of bodily freedom as the filmmaker-poet Pier Paolo Pasolini and the philosopher Michel Foucault. It also features Eberstadt's own interviews with the Russian punk feminist group Pussy Riot and the political artist Pyotr Pavlensky. Running through her narrative of the body militant is Eberstadt's own story and the story of her mother, a New York writer and glamour figure of the 1960s, whose illness-scarred body first led Eberstadt to seek the connections between beauty, belief, and the truths taught by bodily and psychic pain. Early on in Bite Your Friends, Fernanda recalls Wittgenstein, who explains that the purpose of philosophy is to show the fly how to get out of the fly bottle. She then explains that the prophets, philosophers, artists, and martyrs that we'll encounter in her book are the ones who prefer to smash the fly bottle altogether. It's Eberstadt's conviction that in bearing witness to these heroic misfits and societal outcasts who have so completely laid life bare through their own bodies, the writer and the reader might also be transformed. I met with Fernanda one morning in February 2023 at the office of AHMM in Clerkenwell, where the Architecture Foundation is based. Just as a side note, you'll hear a bit of background office noise in the second half of the recording after we change locations. And now, my interview with Fernanda Eberstadt. You've described it as a book about how philosophers, saints, revolutionaries, and contemporary artists have used their bodies as a field of political action.
Yeah.
And how bodies become sites of resistance to the world as it is.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me more about how the body became the locus for you in this book?
I think I realized the concept of it sort of started from this one figure, and I didn't realize this is what was happening, was I wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine about this Russian protest artist, Pyotr Pavlensky, and he is an outrageous guy. And his most famous act was sitting naked in the middle of Red Square in the winter and nailing this big sort of crucifixion-style nail through his scrotum. So sort of nailing himself, nailing a scrotum to a cobblestone as an act of protest. And the images of that act, which are so extreme, so violent, so disturbing, but where he himself shows this kind of very strange inwardness, meditative, peaceful, spiritual ease, just started making me think about, you know, how people have used their own sort of suffering, martyred, extreme bodies as a, you know, to protest an inhuman environments, political systems, you know, as religious self-definition.
Mm-hmm.
So what you can do, you know, the body in a public space. It's the most, you know, Red Square under the Kremlin is the most sort of extreme politicized, you know, expression of power, state power. Mm-hmm. And he's this naked man who's using his own sort of nakedness and vulnerability as a weapon.
It's almost like the body becomes the most expressive form.
Yes.
Whether it's about political dissent,
mm-hmm,
or self-discovery,
yes,
or artistic expression, or religious ecstasy,
hmm,
all these extreme states of being,
yeah,
somehow find their center in the body itself.
Yes.
And I wonder if we could kind of trace back a genealogy of your interest in this subject.
I was working my way backwards because I came up with this idea of the body as a site of political protest and thought of it, you know, almost in a kind of academic way of going from saints and philosophers to protest artists. And it was kind of only then that I realized the personal element. Why am I fascinated by the tortured, suffering body, protesting body? And I realized it sort of came back to my mother and my own early childhood. My mother was this great beauty, sort of self-created beauty, who socialite, New York socialite, who went out every night to parties. My father was a fashion photographer. He took a lot of pictures of her. He loved dressing her up in very exotic designer clothes, photographing her. But her body was this very stylized work of art. But it also was this kind of suffering, ill body, because from the time she was 30, so when I was, say, 6 years old, she had these different kinds of illnesses, diseases, cancers, and got very, very chopped up, very mutilated, very scarred. So from me, both, I grew up with this mother who I thought was going to die at any moment, and sort of was going to die at any moment, but didn't. And also looking at her wrists, her arms, her calves, which were all kind of chopped up from melanomas, from having IVs, from kidney failure. So it was, the beautiful body was a suffering body, and especially a woman's body was a kind of chopped up, scarred, mutilated body.
And the root of her suffering, if we could even begin to articulate it, seems to have been a kind of depression.
Yeah.
And that the antidepressants she was prescribed damaged her kidneys and led to these treatments, which then kind of distorted or deformed her body to some extent. I think the kind of basis of the depression that you describe in the book has to do with a kind of thwarted sense of creative expression.
Yeah.
That your mother was a novelist as well as a socialite.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, instead of fully becoming an artist, she became an artist's muse.
Yes.
So she was moving in the circle of Andy Warhol and very present in the factory scene, as were you, I understand it.
Yeah, a bit later. Yeah. Yes, I think she started out very precocious. Her father was a poet, was this poet, Ogden Nash. She grew up as writing. She always wrote. She published her first novel when she was 21. She always wanted to be a writer. That's what she was. But she got a little bit sidetracked. She married my father, who was very into parties, glamour, art objects, and who kind of helped her or made her become this kind of art object by dressing her up. Andy Warhol did a screen test of her. She's one of his 13 most beautiful women. This underground filmmaker, Jack Smith, took photographs of her, sort of made a film of her. Later, the theater director, Robert Wilson, she acted in a play of his. So she became it. She was kind of an enabler. She loved very outrageous, flamboyant, extreme experimental artists, and she liked helping them realize their vision. So she loved becoming an object, a sort of art object for them. Mm-hmm. But the more, I think for her, the experience of being looked at, of performing and being an object, kind of hollowed her out and made her much more depressed and unable to produce her own work. I think she kind of lost that sort of secret inwardness, meditativeness, freedom to sort of daydream and freedom to explore that helps you create.
In a way, the figures you've collected in this book are your muses, your mother amongst them, and have enabled you to articulate something about not only your biography and your relationship to your mother, but about this idea of the body as this expressive tool.
Yes.
And I want to start with, for you, a foundational muse in the book, which is Diogenes.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about your attraction to this Greek philosopher, what his ideas meant to you, and how he became a kind of catalyst for introducing the book to the reader?
Yeah, he is kind of the start of it for me. And he's an interesting philosopher because almost nothing survives. It's just his sayings. It's his sayings, and above all, it's kind of his actions. So he kind of struck me as being, you know, in a way, he's like a conceptual artist. He very antinomian. His theme is kind of disgrace, dispossession, disinvestment, and disgrace. It's a kind of a series of negatives. You know, he came from a prominent family. His father supposedly operated a mint in a kind of Black Sea colony, embezzled money, was kind of like exiled. So Diogenes hit the road, came as a kind of itinerant to mainland Greece, and preached this gospel of nothingness, of kind of really rubbing your nose in the dirt, of living, you know, he lived in the public square, he sort of had sex, he ate, he drank, he slept in the public square, in the marketplace, he begged for scraps, he disrupted Plato's lectures, teachings by, you know, carrying a dead chicken, throwing it at Plato. He was a very disruptive protest artist, a kind of gutter artist, and his teachings are, you know, despise possessions, despise, don't care what people think, that you are only truly free when you have nothing, and when people, you know, when people are sort of looking down at you. Mm-hmm. The book's title comes from a saying of his, which is, I bite my friends to cure them. So he was kind of like the rabid, he was the mad dog. And I liked that. I liked his extreme contrariness and his extreme freedom. Mm-hmm. And that kind of attracted me.
Maybe it's helpful now to kind of follow the book through its mm-hmm. progressions. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there are specific figures that you think are most useful to delve into.
Yeah. You know, one of the hardest for us to reach is there's this Carthaginian martyr who comes pretty early on, who seems very, very inhuman to us. Her name's Perpetua, so she's living in the early 4th century. And she wants to die. Or she wants to be sacrificed as a kind of to prove her point about freedom. And she's particularly, you know, inhuman seeming figure because she's got a baby and she's kind of like nursing her baby. So why would, you know, and she gets put to death with another young woman, a sort of fellow Christian who gives birth the day before they die. And I found Perpetua's diaries. I mean, they're online, they're not hard to find, but it's kind of like this early 4th century prison diary of this young woman and she just writes with this incredible sort of freedom and simplicity and naturalness. This very, very sort of natural voice and has this total self-confidence. She's a powerful one. There's my friend from when I was a teenager, Stephen Varable, who is a transvestite street performer, costume artist who made all this stuff out of garbage, who took me, when I was sort of like 14 years old, he would take me out to this, you know, the West Side piers to sort of wander around and look at all the strange kind of stuff that was going on in the sort of abandoned warehouses and the West Side Highway and to gay leather bars. He again is another figure of very perverse, very contrarian, but also another, you know, for me, another kind of prophet, another kind of hero, because he's somebody who just believe, you know, every time he left the house, he would sort of risk getting attacked by gangs or having bottles thrown at him because he was, you know, dressed up in a kind of Victorian ball gown made out of egg cartons and or a little matador, you know, bullfighter on his head, some miniature souvenir. He had these outrageous, or, you know, a toy airplane as a codpiece. He had these outrageous costumes.
At one point in the book, you recount asking Stephen mm-hmm. what he believes in. Mm-hmm. And he responds that, "I believe in the purity of artifice and the grandeur of the gutter." Mm-hmm. And then I think he asks you what you believe in, or you ask yourself, and the answer is that you believe in Stephen Varble.
Yes, yeah, yes.
Can you tell me more about the faith you have in people like Varble?
Well, I think you've sort of reached at something interesting, which is that sort of conflict or that interplay between contemplation, posedness, and action, and I think all the characters, all the people in this book, a lot of them are people who sort of live out their ideals in this very extreme bodily way. I'm very attracted to these people who live out their beliefs in a physical way, who are willing to sort of risk life in prison, martyrdom, jail, for a notion of freedom. And I'm so attracted to it because I'm such a scaredy cat myself. And so throughout the book, it's there's this kind of running theme of bravery versus cowardice. And everybody I admire and everybody I'm writing about are these extreme activists. These people are into absolute sort of extreme action and really burying themselves in public and risking everything. And yet I keep on asking myself, why am I cowering in my workroom? Why do I need to be alone in a room with a closed door, 12 hours a day? And I can think up any number of justifications. That's what I do. I'm a writer. But there are writer activists.
Do you see writing as a cowardly act?
I see avoiding action as a cowardly act. I see needing to be alone in front of a screen, for me, feels like an evasion of duty and, a kind of withdrawal. Mm.
I want to step back for a moment and talk about the sense of freedom mm-hmm. that you gain from looking at these people and learning about their lives and their actions, despite your own inaction.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
At some point in the book, you focus on the philosopher Foucault,
yes,
who I'm sure a lot of listeners are familiar with. In a way, he's permeated the mainstream or certain parts of his thinking. And yet, I don't think a lot of people are very familiar with his own actions and his own life and how hard he fought against his own oppression. You take examples of his own extreme actions of self-mutilation and intense acts of intimacy and experiments in psychedelics as well as emblematic of the philosopher who is performing his own thought.
Yeah.
And in a way, you're paraphrasing what you take to be his belief in limit experiences as a way of freeing the body from the prison of the soul. Mm-hmm. But one of his projects in particular seems to somehow map onto the book itself, mm-hmm. which is this projected series of biographies called The Lives of the Infamous.
Yes.
In which he's writing portraits of freaks and criminals whose stories he discovered in public archives. There was only one that was ever written before he died, and that was of the hermaphrodite Abel Barbin. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at Foucault's own attraction to these figures, you're noticing that, in a way, he's writing himself.
Yeah.
Or that he's revealing an innermost part of himself in this process of producing the biography.
Mm, yeah.
And I'm wondering now what of yourself you find in these figures mm-hmm. and to what extent your own inaction is somehow satisfied through or remedied or redeemed through the act of producing the biography, for the act of framing these figures and rendering them more public.
There's sort of, I would say, above all, there's these two figures in the book, Foucault and then the filmmaker poet Pier Paolo Pasolini, who are sort of much more contemplative figures, less kind of action men. Foucault, I'm writing a lot about his, you know, his same, you know, his being an intensely sort of cerebral, you know, figure for whom, who feels very, very broken, very broken, very fragile, very locked up in his own body and needing these kind of very thick institutional walls to hold himself together. And for Foucault, he used his sort of, his self-mutilation wasn't public. That was kind of like a private thing. It was private sort of gay S&M bar thing, but he did psychedelic drugs were for him a kind of way of escaping his nerdy, fearful, you know, professorial self. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the sort of confines of intellect. So his mind was kind of, his mind was what imprisoned him, and he just was desperate to escape it. There's this great moment where he's being interviewed by a sociology professor who asks him about, you know, well, I thought French people were so pleasure loving and, you know, you seem a little Spartan. And he said, yeah, I have to confess, I do not know the meaning of pleasure. I don't like food. I don't like wine. I don't like dinner with friends. I don't really enjoy music or art. You know, only drugs can sort of get me out of myself. And that's why, and I'm longing for an extreme experience, extreme escape. And it's kind of, you know, for him, death, violent death would be the ultimate. Would be the ultimate sort of epiphany, a sort of revelation.
And I just keep, I'm just like kind of thinking off the record in a way now. I'm just, I really don't know how to do this. It's such an unusual project in a way, uh-huh. But it's also one that's so familiar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To me.
Yes.
Like when I opened the first page, mm-hmm. and I saw these lines from Diogenes, I kind of felt like I knew you.
Uh-huh, that's nice. Oh, good.
I recognize the sentiment, mm-hmm. of finding a kind of meaning or a guidance through the ideas of people like Diogenes. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking back to, you know, my encounters with art.
Yeah.
And formative experiences for me. And I was brought back to the basement of the Kunsthaus in Vienna, which I visited in my early 20s. And saw the work of the Viennese actionists on film.
Oh my God, did you? Wow. Whoa. Yeah. I mean, they are irresistible. They are. What did you think?
It changed my life.
Damn. So you sort of saw people smearing themselves in shit or setting themselves on fire, you know, whatever it was.
And I didn't know what to do with the experience at the time. Mm-hmm. I still don't really know what to make of it now.
Yeah.
But I'm intrigued by my own intrigue with the subject matter,
yeah.
of extreme performance art.
Yes.
Of life laid bare,
yes.
through acts of intense self-sacrifice, mm-hmm. in a way.
Yeah.
And you talk about the kind of liberation that figures like Foucault are seeking,
yeah.
through their own extreme experiences. But it really seems like the liberation you found is in simply recounting theirs.
Yeah, yes.
And I just wonder if you could talk more about how that's become a project for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is it enough? You called yourself a scaredy cat.
Yeah.
And you seem to, in a way, regret your own inaction, mm-hmm. as you've put it. But do you see writing as its own form of action?
I mean, it better be. I think, you know, when you say you kind of recognize me, you recognize yourself on the first page of my book, you know, that's kind of like the highest praise you can, you know, I can get in a way. I've got a friend who I've known forever who read the book and said, And the phrase he used was radical identification. He felt a radical identification with it. I think what I'm writing about, aside from people who take very brave, extreme action, I'm also writing about that experience of feeling like an absolute freak, of being an absolute freak, and putting out a message, you know, for sort of fellow misfits or people who just can't, I use this phrase, the world as it is, people who can't live with the pre-invented world.
I mean, I think it has something to do with participation. Mm-hmm. And near the end of the book, you write briefly about the artist Adrienne Piper.
Yeah.
And there's a film of hers where she is alone in the street in Berlin, dancing and dipping and leaping in the middle of a square. And you're wondering if this is someone you've always known, mm-hmm. or if it's someone you'd like to be.
Yeah.
And to me, again, mm-hmm. there's a recognition there in our familiarity, I think, of encountering these kinds of people and seeing something in them that elicits a certain longing, mm-hmm. a longing to join.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think near the very end of the book, the only time we see words in all caps is when you're inviting us all to get down and party together.
Yeah.
Like to kind of join the fray, to enter not the world as you observe it, but the world as it could be with you in it somehow. Mm,
yes. Well, that's a phrase from Adrienne Piper, from her writing. She's a brilliant writer too. And she's a very emblematic figure for me because she, again, is this incredibly cerebral, incredibly brilliant philosopher, thinker, who's makes herself do through, you know, from the sort of 70s on, do these extreme sort of performance art, action art, to, you know, smears herself in stinking, you know, fish oil and sits in a public bus or a subway, makes herself very, you know, physically, turns herself into this kind of physically repellent, threatening character who she calls mythical being, and who sort of comes into public space. And I like that combination. Or she dances in the middle of, she's 70 years old and she's dancing in the middle of Berlin, Alexanderplatz, all by herself, you know, for like an hour or two. She's kind of entering public space in a sort of, in a way that challenges everybody's sense of privacy, safety, decorum, you know, in a very Diogenes-like way. That takes a lot of guts, and it makes us all question our sense of safety and what holds us together. She's a solitary artist, but who also is sort of calling out for this kind of community. And I think, you know, a lot of the figures I admire, a lot of the artists and thinkers in this book are people who believe in a collective, who believe in an ecstatic collective, and yet are still somehow kind of locked up in their own heads, the way I'm locked up in my own head, much as I long for, you know, some fantasy of collective action, collective communal belonging and being.
For me, it really invites a possibility for a kind of collectivity that has yet to be realized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we like to talk about the collective.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We architects.
Yes. Yeah.
We love the idea of the communal. Mm-hmm. And yet these terms have become quite sanitized, uh-huh. and in a way too safe.
Uh-huh. Yes.
We want the collective without the difficulty of really living together.
Yeah, yes.
And I think there's something about, maybe to go back to Diogenes, this cosmopolitanism.
Yeah.
Which he was a proponent of, this idea that we are all citizens of the world.
Yeah.
That, and it's that binds us.
Mm-hmm.
it's this idea of cosmopolitanism that is maybe drawing me somehow closer to the sense of the collective that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Because in order for him to uncover his thinking about the cosmopolitan, he's resorting to quite extreme and intense actions.
Yeah.
And I think it's somehow that lack of risk, in a way, in public life that has dimmed the idea of the communal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, yes. I mean, it's kind of strange if I'm thinking about architecture and architects in those terms, because architects are always people who are telling other people and organizing other people how to live, you know, in spaces they themselves are not going to inhabit, mostly. So yeah, you're hanging back. You're sort of dictating a manner of living, a kind of ideal of living.
Mm-hmm.
But as you kind of mentioned at the beginning, you're observing. Mm. You're the angel on high, who are sort of watching it.
But I think that there is a kind of risk involved in joining the fray.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As someone who's inscribing the rule or the order on the kind of daily habits or the daily movements of one's life.
Yes.
And I think the risk, I really don't know where I'm going with this, but I mean, I teach architecture students.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of people who are teaching. And there's a lot of risk, I think, involved in exploring collective life.
Yes.
That there's a prescribed or circumscribed way of talking about social life and identity. There are right and wrong ways of doing it now.
Yeah.
And there's a real anxiety and reluctance, I find, especially among students, to make mistakes and misspeak or make the wrong assumptions or imply that they could design for a collective that they don't necessarily feel they belong to. Mm-hmm. So I feel like in a way we all need to join the fray somehow.
Yes, yes.
And I'm kind of talking around matters, but maybe directly, like I'm just remembering an anecdote. A student of mine who herself is Vietnamese was working on a project, a speculative studio project, in a part of the city where there is a concentration of Afro-Caribbean people. And at one point, she stood back and decided it would be inappropriate for her to continue with the project because she was designing for a community that didn't resemble her.
Yeah, yes.
And to me, there's a real panic.
That's a good word.
Around that kind of remove from the idea of communal life and the risks of collectivity that I feel like is quite pervasive in the way we think about how we make the built environment, how we make public spaces, and who makes them and for whom.
Yes. Well, architecture's always, I mean, to me, it's always seemed like, and the architects I know, it always seemed to me like the most dictatorial, it's the most dictatorial profession because of this thing. You traditionally, you are deciding how other people should live. I have an architect friend who, I remember some years ago, he sort of said to me, he builds private spaces, and he said his favorite thing is telling the client whatever they want they can't have, and he doesn't care what it is. It's kind of like an exercise in power and assertion. He said, if, you know, they say, you know, I'd like some floor length mirrors. And he said, oh, no mirrors. There are no mirrors. You are not allowed to have any mirrors in this apartment. I do not do mirrors, no mirrors. And whatever it is, he needs to do that. And now that is such an, you know, that is the opposite of the political times we're living in, our cultural moment. So obviously it's impossible to dictate to somebody else how the space they should live in.
Uh-huh. And to be clear, it's the opposite of how we understand the practice of architecture now, to the extent that authorship is if not taboo, it's certainly frowned upon. The idea that there can be a singular author.
Yeah.
And some a kind of facet of that is incredibly exciting. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, to me, it does mark a kind of diminishment of authority in a way, a necessary authority.
Yeah.
And I think these are the complications, the murky complications of the creative expression of architecture that I'm somehow feeling my way around when I read your work. Mm-hmm. Because you're drawn to and find inspiration and freedom through these highly authoritative figures.
Yeah.
And yet the authority they're enacting is over their own bodies.
Yes.
Against a broader overarching power structure.
Yeah.
A societal inhibition, political control, that through having authority over themselves, they can dissolve these oppressive systems. Mm-hmm. And there's a real conflict here.
Yeah.
And this idea of authority that we maybe see in people like Pavlensky.
Yeah, Pavlensky. Yeah, that he turns out to be, or to me, he turns out to be absolutely power obsessed, that everything is against power, but he's this, every detail of his life, every detail of his art is resisting power.
So I think we have to move now.
Okay.
If you want to just put that in your pocket, we'll just keep it going.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm really groping around here. I think it'll be boiled down. We could talk now about the specific sites of action that you lay out in the book. There's this notion, again from Foucault, about the heterotopia as a space of possibility.
Yes. A lot of his were actually enclosed spaces, and they were these kind of spaces of transition or liminal spaces where sort of usual laws or customs didn't apply. So he thought of ships, train compartments, convents. He liked sort of spaces of monosexuality. Cemeteries aren't indoors, but cemeteries for some reason that where everything's, all the rules are suspended. Mm. And he didn't mention some of his own favorite heterotopias, like, you know, leather bars. Mm. But it's this, or baths, but I got very drawn in this book to different kinds of heterotopias because it seemed that a lot of my heroes, I was writing about these people who are sort of misfits, but it also seemed to me that they were drawn to places that were sort of misfit places, sort of outlaw spaces, that they each needed to find their own space to be misfits in. So there's a lot of ruin, a lot of kind of like vacant lots, ruined, disused spaces in between wasteland for each of the characters I'm writing about. So Stephen Varble, this transvestite artist, took me to the West Side Highway to all the ruined piers and warehouses there, which at that time, you know, in the 1970s, were undeveloped, were kind of ruined, undeveloped places for sort of anonymous gay male sex, but also for kinds of art. You know, Gordon Matta Clark sort of repurposed a ruined warehouse for one of his installations. David Vonarovich used to make art, his stenciling on the walls of warehouses. So for that was one kind of space like that, this no man's land, this trucker's docks of New York piers. There were other zones for Pasolini. There was this whole other kind of like field of nothingness, of in-between, indeterminacy, kind of fugitive secret space for sexual encounters again. He grew up in Friuli in this kind of very flat, marshy land. And so his youth was spent, youth in his 20s were spent sort of looking for boys in the in this very idyllic space for him of kind of riverbank bathing holes where kind of field workers would come at the end of the day and strip off and swim. And that's where he, that's where, those were his kind of amorous encounters. You know, once he reaches Rome, he writes a lot about the kind of shanty towns, which are his kind of favorite space, and all the kind of stuffed barges on the river. And then eventually he was, the spot where he was murdered is kind of like a totally idyllic spot for him. It's called the Idroscalo at Ostia. And it's this place, it was kind of this wasteland, garbage dump, delta space where there were sort of illegal shanties where people were living, but also just kind of like undergrowth brush. So for me, that's got, it's got a very personal fascination, those kind of no man's lands, because when I was a kid growing up in New York, I used to, running around the city, I was very attracted to kind of vacant lots and buildings that were half demolished, where things were less policed back then, and you could sort of climb over walls or climb into construction sites and just kind of root around and forage.
I think these kinds of spaces, these terrain vague environments, are also very attractive to architects.
Are they?
There's a real cult of fascination around figures like Tarkovsky. And the spaces that he's found for his films, especially Stalker.
Especially Stalker.
Which I feel like really embody this ruined and ambiguous state of possibility that you're describing. But equally, people like Derek Jarman and his garden in this desert region. And
that is, I mean, Derek Jarman in that garden just feels like the ultimate, this little microcosm of that notion distilled. I mean, to be in this nuclear site, this kind of totally toxic industrial site, you know, that's totally inhospitable and all gravelly and not, you know, unfertile land, and to make some garden out of the ruin.
Yeah, it's its own kind of resistance in a way.
Yes.
So tell me more about the environment that you've chosen for yourself to make the work that you make.
Yeah, I live in the country in France, and I've got this, my workroom is just a total sanctuary. It's the it's the small little room. It was kind of like a maid's room on the top floor of this house. I've got a million photographs and pictures on the wall. I mean, every inch of wall space is kind of covered in these kind of private mementos and things I picked up on the beach. And that's my absolute refuge, sanctuary, happiest place on earth. And some, you know, the attraction, the magnetic attraction of it is overpowering. I always want to be back there.
It's a real virtual environment in a way, or it's an environment that allows you this very deep access to other lives.
Yes.
Through either your intensive reading or in your writing, your imagination of other subjective experience.
Yes.
And again, it's a kind of, in many ways, opposed to these heterotopias of action.
Yes. Well, I sort of always, I'm always admiring, I mentioned my grandfather was a poet, and he used to compose, he wrote you know, a poem every day, and he always composed in the living room with his grandchildren running around.
This is Ogden Nash.
Yeah, everybody making a lot of noise. And he liked that tumult and commotion, and he had no sense of sort of like poetry being an arcane thing or needing privacy. It just was completely every day, like doing his accounts. I admire that, but I'm not that person. I love writing, and I write very, very easily, and I produce very naturally. It's a very easy, happy flow, but I need those closed doors. I need absolute solitude.
I wonder if we could talk briefly about how you began writing. There is this one interview. It's a show, it was a show called Firing Line, I think, with William F. Buckley. And you're on stage with
Brett Easton Ellis.
Brett Easton Ellis, as these two young, exciting, emerging novelists who can tell the next generation something about the changing times, I guess, mm-hmm. or the changing tide. And then you gravitated towards a real political conservatism. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about that. First of all, the first blush of success as a novelist, and what seems like a kind of inner conflict around how one ought to live morally.
So my first novel, I sort of wrote at university, then it got published when I was 24. That's when the Ready to Novelist, instead of me, that television interview came. By that point, I'd sort of adopted these very extreme neoconservative politics. When I came out of university.
You write in the book that your conversion to right-wing religious Zionism was in fact a reaction to this unboundaried childhood.
I'd grown up in this super permissive, kind of limitless, no bedtime, no rules, very wild childhood, wild, you know, parents didn't look out, didn't wonder where their kids were in those days. So super permissive, super druggy, experimental, unbordered, unboundaried way. And then I got kind of scared. So I had a longing for order and authority and somebody to tell me what to do. And I loved the rules. I sort of was going to convert to Judaism. I loved being able to, being told what to do every end of the day, what I could eat, what I could wear, what I couldn't. I found that very, very reassuring and very comforting. And I also also have a bent for different forms of ecstasy, including religious ecstasy. So that part was really nice. So on the William F. Buckley show, that's kind of like me as neocon. I slowly lost the faith. So I spent a lot of years writing essays for neoconservative magazines that were kind of like attacking left-wing novelists. And I wish I hadn't, but I did. I kind of slowly lost it. It just stopped making sense to me. I sort of lost my politics, lost my religion.
Later on, you wrote a book about the gypsy community who lived nearby your home in rural France.
Yeah.
In a way, it's an equally extreme manifestation of control.
Oh, how do you see that?
Maybe in terms of their curtailing of rights, particularly the women.
Yeah, yes.
The opportunities available to children in terms of education and literacy. There's a kind of closing off to the world in relation to the gypsies that you're writing about that seems kind of extreme as well. And at the same time, there's so much to appreciate and cherish about this culture.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think it's that seeming contradiction or that tension around both the lack of rights or opportunities, and at the same time the beauty that emerges from this culture that I'm intrigued by, and your ability to hold those two at the same time.
Yeah.
What's exciting to me about this attitude is that you're approaching the unknown, whether it's an environment or a culture or individuals, with, instead of indignation and outrage, you come with an intense curiosity. And I find that so motivating or inspiring that when presented or confronted with very difficult subjects, very difficult others, the instinct is to get as close as possible.
You know, I think I invite your friends, I write about this thing, which I do experience every day, of being in the subway, being in the underground, and just you find it unbearable that, you know, you're seeing all these strangers and you see people's faces and you sort of eavesdropping on people's conversations and you really, you know, I want to get to know them.
I read this line and made note. You wrote, in a crowded subway, I'd experience this overwhelming tenderness for the other passengers. It seemed unbearably sad that you couldn't dissolve the boundaries between strangers.
Yeah, yes, I feel that so strongly. So I feel sort of the opposite of what happened to everybody else during COVID. You know, I just want, you know, no barriers. Right? I love those places, where strangers talk to each other. I love those spaces where that's possible in our worlds, in our cities, but also those places where the borders are a little less fixed, where you do say hi to strangers in the street. I am very hungry for those encounters. Mm. Journalist is a great excuse. If you're an anthropologist, again, it's a great excuse. You know, you just need excuses. I need excuses to talk to strangers to get to.
And I think for architects as well, there's this excitement around these more ambiguous environments.
Yeah.
Environments of encounter,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. As opposed to highly delineated and defined spaces.
Mm.
So I spoke with architects called Apparata a couple weeks ago.
Oh yeah, I listened to that. Oh, it was really, really good. Yeah.
I mean, to me, it's the Lyft lobby.
Yeah.
That becomes a place to eat dinner.
Yes. Yeah.
Or the catwalk that links three bedrooms, actually, in different households. Or the soft spots in the walls that open up a whole floor to intergenerational living. I mean, there's a kind of utopianist ideal here, but there's also this desire for the dissolving of boundaries, as you articulated as well. But at the same time, I'm aware of the kind of contradictions around realizing communities like that. In which a certain amount of social engineering inevitably happens.
Yes.
That not just anybody can live in these places so close together with so much connection.
But you need to make it. At the other extreme, my daughter's works as a social worker, and mostly with women. The last project she was on was homeless women who'd been housed. This was in London. They've been housed by the borough, and a lot of them got really unhappy because they were put in these sort of single-person apartments, flats that were sort of nice and clean, but they weren't allowed to bring their animals. They weren't allowed to have their grown children living with them who they were trying to reconnect with, and so a lot of times people would go back to the streets because where they were living, you know, rough but in communities and. With a lot of other people, so now she's trying to figure out how do you get what's this ideal? This sort of social ideal can be quite lonely. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you find more collective ways of living? Doesn't it make people happier? Mm-hmm. Most people happier to live more in a more neighborly way.
Do you think writing this book, Bite Your Friends, has changed the way that you live?
No, I think it's thrown me back probably even more firmly and on my own limitations, on my own kind of necessary limitations and how much solitude I actually need. Huh. And that I've got to I've got to accept the contradictions between what I think makes people happy and what might even make me happy and what you know, my own kind of fractures and brokenness, needing solitude, loving collective action and needing a lot of solitude.
I think that's a beautiful place to end.
Good.
I think for me, it somehow reinforces this sense of the communal as being reliant upon an incompleteness that we bring to each other, and an acknowledgement of those shortcomings we carry into the world.
Yeah, yes.
And at the same time, a recognition of how they're maybe fulfilled in other people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And for me, that's radical.
yeah.
So thank you, Fernanda.
Good. Thank you so much, Matthew. I really, I'm very happy to be on your show. Yeah.
I feel like I could talk to you all day.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And you can see that I'm really fumbling.
You've been listening to Scaffold. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @Scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes. Thanks to Fernanda Eberstadt, thanks as always to Scandalin, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.